Welcome aboard. It's episode 49 of the J.R. Heft Show. And once again, we are shouting along the James with Norm Leahy. Norm, happy soggy Wednesday, Thursday.
Almost. Yeah. You're all buttoned up on your end?
Yes. The hatches are all battened down, and we're all locked up nice and tight here in southern Chesapeake. As rightly so, it's been a pretty dicey few days as we've been trying to figure out what's going on down here.
Now, are the evacuations still in effect for the low-lying areas along there?
Yes. Zone A, all of the Zone A areas, and it's almost like a checkerboard if you look at the tidewater. So you can't just say, oh, the coastal areas of Virginia Beach, those are all Zone A and they're all evacuated. Well, yes and no. It just depends on where you are. And there are some inland areas that are nearby to me in Chesapeake that are Zone A that have been evacuated as well. But to answer your question, yes, all of the Outer Banks and most of the counties in coastal North Carolina, they have been evacuated. Zone A here in Virginia, a lot of folks throughout the Virginia Beach and Chesapeake and Hampton areas, they have been evacuated and sent along. And we're just watching for mainly the surge. That is the thing that is going to bother us, as always, to cycle along with the tides. So when it's high tide and we get a storm surge, people around here, rightfully so, get nervous. And quite frankly, when it comes to Norfolk, it can just sprinkle and we've got flooding. So,
Well, is that God's way of saying it's time to move out of the swamp and maybe seek out higher ground?
Well, you know, it could be partially that. I mean, I know George Washington came down here back in the day and said that he wanted to drain the Great Dismal Swamp. Put that one on for size. Washington wanted to drain the swamp. Anyway.
But he found there was no money in it, so it didn't happen.
That's right. Washington, I can see a t-shirt already, you know, Washington, the original guy who drained the swamp or something like that. We'll have to work on that one.
The original swamp drainer or there something like that.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. But we're going to be nervous here in terms of the amount of rainfall between tomorrow, Friday, and Saturday. And we'll just see where the storm goes. I want to knock on wood and say that as far as Virginia goes, we're going to be okay based upon the current track trajectory. My column for the Prince of Sand Independent this week was hoping for that, praying for that. Indeed, it looks like that may have happened. So that's good.
Yeah, but keep your eyes open for next week when the thing wraps around as a depression and maybe goes up the Shenandoah Valley.
Exactly. You know, when we were looking to see whether or not we were going to stick around or head out of here, we actually looked to Virginia Tech and the Roanoke and Blacksburg area because that's kind of, you know, we travel out there a lot for my daughter. Everybody knows she goes to Tech. But what I had noticed in terms of the storm models is that area was expected to get like 12 inches of rain. It was expected to get more rain than we were anticipating here.
Yeah, and it'd be worse because of the topography.
My understanding is that the western part of the state actually floods pretty significantly.
Well, yeah, and there were the huge, I can't remember after which storm, was it Hazel, was it Camille, the floods that hit Nelson County? I think the Pilot did a big retrospective story on that, and they were absolutely horrific, the damage that was done there. And that was from one that it had already come ashore, it had already made its trip, and it just happened to decide, you know, it's time to wring out the sponge here. And it just, you can still see the scars of it today.
Absolutely. Well, I think what I'm impressed by is that, for the most part, politics has been kept out of the conversation, which is good. Looks like Governor Northam and the state's emergency response mechanisms have been in place. Folks were not messing around on this one. From a federal perspective, President Trump declared a state of emergency for Virginia as well. So both at the state level and the federal level, the administration was taken care of well in advance to make sure that everybody was prepared for this. Now, where I live in reference to the Outer Banks is I'm about the second exit, or I'm the first exit after the tolls on the 168 bypass. And we were out of gas beginning on Monday.
Really?
Yeah. So it's been a little bit of an inconvenience for those of us who kind of live in this area outside of the Outer Banks. But already, you know, gas has been replenished. Looks like, you know, the limitations that have been placed on trucking, I know that those limitations were drawn back. So folks in the Maryland and Virginia and North Carolina area, looks like you're going to have the fuel and the necessities that you're going to need to get through this.
Yeah, and I do understand, too, where it's going, potentially going now. Of course, it's going to go for my son, who's down in Columbia, and my mother-in-law. So that'll be fun. That'll be fun around the household here to watch develop over the next few days.
Yep, and that's something of concern, too. I mean, we're hear about Virginia, but I am really worried about the folks down in the Carolinas. Talk about your family a little bit better. I mean, how prepared are they?
Well, they're as prepared. It's sort of like having two additional children, except they're 6.5 hours away. And they're as prepared as they can be. The university down there is doing what it can for students. They're supposed to today be offering free stuff for the kids, you know, supplies. We had to rouse the boy to go and do that, though, because he's a teenager. And, you know, it's just this ain't their first rodeo. And they arguably have far more experience with really bad storms than even Virginia does, because we tend to forget storms like Hugo that didn't make wobbles and turns and dips and dodges. It came barreling straight in to South Carolina, hit Charleston, kept right on motoring through, and they got popped really badly. And one of the places where we perennially go to the beach, depending upon the model you follow, the eye could go right over that island, and I don't know how much of it will remain after the battering that it will take from the sea, not from the wind so much, but from, like you were talking about, the surge. Because it's a barrier island, they are supposed to be movable. And yet people, in our wisdom, decided, let's build expensive homes there.
Right.
Because it's fun. And so and they just rebuilt the dunes there. So I'm sure all of that's going to be washed away. So they're going to be suffering. They're really going to be suffering. And one thing I saw this on the news this morning, too, that region of the country has, I think, one of the nation's largest concentrations of nuclear power plants.
Mm-hmm.
And under I think it's the Nuclear Regulatory Commission regulations. If they get hurricane force winds, they have to shut down.
Right.
And it's not just like flipping a light switch. There's a process. And
sure.
It's the same with turning it back on. You don't just, well, okay, turn it over, Mac. You know, you have to go through a process. So there was some hand-wringing about, well, gosh, they'll have to replace that electricity eventually in the interim with coal and natural gas. And I thought, well, good. You want to have alternative resources and not put all of your eggs, even if it's a nuclear one, in one basket, because things happen. And Mother Nature doesn't care where your power source comes. It's got its own.
Yeah, I'll have to look into that as to why the nuclear has to shut down based upon winds, because to me that seems odd. You remember I have done that interview with Dan Stoddard of Dominion Energy. He's their chief nuclear officer, and being a former nuclear reactor operator myself, the winds are not supposed to affect nuclear power plants. So I have never heard of that before.
I had never heard that until this morning.
And that's actually supposed to be one of the advantages of nuclear, is that it's not affected by atmospherics.
Well, apparently there's a rule that says otherwise, because yeah. Reasons.
I'm not doubting you in one bit. I am just feeling like I'm being informed. I gotta learn me something more here.
Yeah, I didn't know that either. But it's not the only storm. I came across another, a smaller storm, a political storm. Let's get back to the nitty gritty for a second. wrote up this week, we've had a real lack of polling data in the congressional races in the Commonwealth, and which is rather stunning considering how many seats are rated toss-ups. Maybe it just tells us more about the state of polling than it does anything else. But the New York Times has been running an experiment the last few days, polling in the 7th Congressional District. And it's an ongoing thing. Part of it was an educational process to show readers how polls are conducted and how many thousands of contacts they have to make before they get somebody to respond. And then the process they go through of trying to weight the responses to fit various models and what the outcomes would be along those various models. But it was still the first real snapshot we've had of what is the Cook Political Report says is a toss-up seat. I was so fascinated by it, I wrote about it in the Post. The final, so they eventually, after making several thousand calls, they made 25,000 calls. They got to 501 people.
Wait, repeat that again?
They made 25,823 calls. 501 people spoke to them.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a microscopic response rate.
Yeah, I mean, you can do far better with direct mail prospecting.
So what is that? So 2,500 would be 10%, which means 250 is 1%. They got a 2% response rate.
Yeah, they did. And it was interesting. They break things down in the crosstabs just like any other poll does. The most difficult group to contact were those people aged 18 to 29. They called 2,700 people there. They spoke to 21.
Wow.
So what they ended up with was poll data that was generally, in their words, older and whiter, which kind of fits the 7th district. It's, let's face it, it's a white bread district. But even so, Bratt comes out on the other side of all of this sausage making, leading Abigail Spanberger, the Democratic nominee, by 6 points. And he's under 50. He was ahead 47-43 with 9% undecided. We both know that as an incumbent seeking reelection, a reelect number under 50 shows you're in trouble. Of course, everything we may have known about politics was blown apart and the ashes burned, the ruins burned after 2016. But still, that raises a flag. And if you dig deeper into the data as the Times broke it out, what you find is some things that obviously make intuitive sense. The Democrat is leading among women. Bratt, the incumbent, is leading among men. Interestingly enough, Abigail Spanberger leads only among one demographic age group, 45 to 64, and that's not really overwhelming. The other one that was rather, I think, telling here, and probably the most important for this race, is the regional breakdown. Bratt was leading in Chesterfield County, but only by a single percentage point. Chesterfield County is big. Ralph Northam carried it for the first time as a Democrat in, before we were born, let's put it that way. And so Abigail Spanberger needs to win there. It's within striking distance. She's ahead of him in Henrico County, the other big population center in the district. Everywhere else in the district, the more rural counties, Bratt has about a 16-point lead, but still with 11% undecided there. His strength always was going to come from those areas. Her strength was always going to come from the Richmond media market. And this poll seems to reinforce what was conventional wisdom. To have a chance to win, though, she needs to crush it in Chesterfield. Otherwise, Bratt's going to win. Even if you roll out undecideds, you know, he's probably ahead 52-48, and that's probably what will happen. One other area of strength that this shows that she has is independence. She's ahead there in this poll, 45-43, but there's 12% undecided. That's where this race will ultimately be decided, is among those who are not self-identified as Republican or Democrat. And I'm not 100% sure how that's going to break. It depends a lot of any number of factors, a big one being in intensity. I have seen various polls in other places in the country about voter intensity. It really depends upon where you are, but broadly speaking, Democrats have been doing well. But, you know, that doesn't mean that they're going to romp in Central Virginia. Still, I thought this was an interesting first real data-ish look at what's happening in this district, and it fit the assumed wisdom. It was going to be close. It is a genuine toss-up, and it looks possibly like the Democrat has room to improve. Whether she does, whether she can, what circumstances evolve between now and Election Day, anybody's guess. But it's interesting to see this actually put numbers to it, and it really will help shape things, I think, as we head up toward Election Day.
Speaking of elections, a couple of radio articles to turn to from WUSA and WTOP regarding how we actually cast our ballots. One article from WTOP says that a Virginia state review has been called for less local control of elections this week, pointing to a rickety IT system, lack of reviews to confirm voters are assigned to the correct districts, and a sense of politics invading the state's Department of Elections is the lead. Governor Ralph Northam said Wednesday that the state has made changes since he was inaugurated in January to help address a number of the issues. We've made a lot of changes, and I don't think Virginians should worry about this, that this is going to happen again, Northam said on WRVA. The review found no evidence of widespread voter fraud in Virginia, concluding that 5.5 million strong voter registration list is largely accurate. However, a problem identified in the report deals with where that list is stored by the state and maintained by local registrars. An aging IT system known as Veris, V-E-R-I-S, that is confusing and slow even when it is not overwhelmed. The system crashed on the last day of voter registration in 2016. So you take that and then you compare it to this other article on WUSA 9. Sorry, that looks like it's television. Which inconveniently has been replaced by a Florence overlay. Get rid of that. Okay, sorry. Okay, so it says that days after officials in Washington disclosed none of a $3 million grant is securing the district's midterm election infrastructure, the same story played out across the Potomac on a scale triple the size. Virginia received a $9 million grant from the federal government, a new investment designed to improve election security in the face of undiminished hacking threats. But the critical swing state with several competitive House races will spend none of the $9 million to prepare for the midterm elections, according to interviews and record requests reviewed by WUSA 9. Okay.
Yeah.
So, wait a second here. On one hand, you're saying that Veris is all screwed up, but we're taking IT steps to improve it. That's what Governor Northam said. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, forgive me. I mean, I'm all for giving taxpayer money back. Don't get me wrong. But here's $9 million that's going to be handed to you to fix the security flaws and issues, and you're not going to spend any of it?
Well,
what's wrong with this picture? What am I missing here?
I don't. It's government. It's government, and government doesn't. Its left and right hands never communicate. So we got a grant. What grant? I didn't hear anything about a grant. We made a grant. No. What are we going to spend it on? Elections? Oh, we don't care about elections. Let's put it this way. Elections are somehow successful despite the problems and despite the errors, and they're largely run by volunteers. It is a wonder that votes get counted at all, and that they do is, I think, largely due to the fact that there's a lot of dedicated people who spend a lot of time making it happen on Election Day. And yeah, there's a lot of things that need to be fixed. Obviously, if your voter file is basically kept in someone's top desk drawer and, you know, right next to their car keys, that's a problem. And that's the kind of data that somebody, I don't know exactly what you're going to do with a voter file, but it's information and it's valuable information. And if the state can't seem to get around to spending the money to shore up the security on its system, that's a real problem. And there was another article that came out of JLARC. Did you see that one about the McAuliffe administration politicizing the Department of Elections?
No, I haven't seen that. Just to wrap this one up, though, you know, reading further down in the article, the administration does plan to spend the money. It's just, you know, it seemed like when the query came out, they were flat-footed with a response. It's just weird in contrast with them saying that, you know, hey, there is no problem. We're taking care of it. We're handling it. And then the next step, they're saying, well, you know, we really don't have a plan for this money. But I haven't seen the JLARC article. What's that all about?
Well, this one came out earlier in the week, obviously, because of all the prep that we've been doing in advance of the storm. It's easy to let something like this slip by. But the JLARC, the General Assembly's audit arm, came out with a report that said that Virginia's Department of Elections was, quote, an environment of open support for one party over the other under the leadership appointed by Governor Terry McAuliffe. I'm not 100% sure that comes as a surprise, because Terry McAuliffe seemed to politicize everything and did a fine job of it, but it was a long report, came out Monday, 75 pages, that pointed to, quote, the perception of political bias and a faulty IT system as two key issues state lawmakers may want to address.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, it's not just that you've got a rickety infrastructure. It's that you've got some hacks appointed to run the whole thing.
Hacks and hackers.
Yeah, together, whether they make a mess.
A big mess. I mean, but, you know, Russian influence over our elections, Chinese trying to hack into our ballot boxes. Nah, nothing to see here. No issues.
No.
I go back to your point, though. There are plenty of reasonable people who, again, our elections really are best when the electronic aspect is kind of taken out of it. It's not going to serve our self-indulgent, self-indulgent is the right word, but where I'm getting at is our need for instant gratification.
Yeah.
You know, the polls close at 7:00. We need to know the results at 7:01 or sooner.
Yeah. I do.
Yeah, right. You know, I want to go to bed. I want to or watch a movie or something. But I think the simple aspect of having more of our ballots just be paper ballots, having them be counted or scantroned or something along those lines. I mean, I know we fill out paper ballot. At least I do. I still fill out a paper ballot and it goes into scantron. It's just making sure that from that process on, that we can have confidence in our results. That's really where it's coming down to. If you've got the organization that's responsible for this being politicized, being, you know, biased towards a certain political party, and you couple that with electronic malfeasance or a lack of security, as you were saying, it erodes at the confidence a voter has in the election results. And that's where we have a problem. And you need to have faith and confidence in the people who are counting the ballots, who are you know, administering the process. If you don't have faith and confidence in the people, then we have a real problem.
Yeah, and it's only going to get worse. So the sooner that the Virginia Department of Elections rights its own ship and decides that, yes, we're supposed to make sure the system works, not put our thumb on a scale, the better off we're all going to be. And if they get around to plugging the holes in the security, well, that'll be just dandy too.
Well said. So the ongoing saga, speaking of elections, again.
Yeah.
So I guess Republicans have said that indeed they are amenable to having a vote or at least having a discussion on redistricting sometime this October so that a judge doesn't have to draw the lines. I don't know. Do you have any feelings on this?
They don't have any choice. Just, they have to do something. Otherwise, a judge will draw the map. And I kind of lean toward the idea that a judge, a special magistrate, whatever, will end up drawing the lines because that's what happened when they had to redraw the congressional district boundaries. Remember, it went to a magistrate to do that because the political process devolved and was incapable of doing so. I think the same thing will happen here. So the idea that, we'll participate. They were always going to participate. They never had the option of not participating. And if they did somehow choose that, it meant somebody else would be making the decisions for them, which may still happen.
Which I honestly feel is the likely, like you said, I think it's the most likely alternative. I think they had to come out and say that they were going to participate.
Yeah.
Even if it's half-hearted, right?
Yes. Even if they phone it in, they have to participate. And the Democrats put up a map of their own. Granted, their leadership didn't seem to understand what the map said. And it wasn't exactly the world's greatest map either, but they started the process. So, yeah, the Republicans had no choice. They had to come back with something. It's just, after a while, I get tired of the dance of, we'd rather have the court decide this. No, you don't. No, you don't, because if court decides it, they're going to draw it for you, Bob. And guess what? You're going to be updating your resume in 2 years.
Well, here's the deal. Democrats came up with a plan that certainly wasn't going to peel away enough Republicans to get them to vote for it. Republicans, the question here is, are they going to come up with a plan that Democrats can potentially agree to? I'm not sure Democrats would agree to a plan that even was something that they could agree to.
Well, especially given the new crop of Democrats. Remember, a lot of those Democrats are ones who beat Republicans under the old lines.
Yeah, so I think that there's just such an intransigence, and the fact that this is all dealing with incumbent protection and self-preservation. Mm-hmm. They're the ones who are drawing the lines, right? I hate to be so cynical and so skeptical of people who've gotten this far into the podcast and are listening to it. We're that way right now. At least I am. I do not have a lot of faith and confidence in the House of Delegates to get stuff done other than stuff that I don't like.
That's why the Commonwealth is safe whenever they're gone. Right. When they're in session, bury the silver. When they leave, now you can breathe again. But as we discussed in an earlier episode, lines are great and they might give you some insulation in times when politics aren't quite as stirred up as they are right now. But when people are agitated, lines really don't matter, as the Republicans found to their chagrin in 2017. Those lines were supposed to protect their incumbents. They didn't.
Well, you look back, I just interviewed Thomas O. in the 8th District, and we forget that Stan Parris actually had that district for about a decade before Jim Moran was elected in 1990, mm-hmm. defeating Stan Parris. Mm-hmm. And so that was right after the war. So had Gulf War won?
That was 1991.
So
was they've all blurred
no,
together.
No, 91. Okay, so it was January, because it happened quick. It happened quick after, like, okay, so yeah, so the Gulf War had not yet happened when Jim Moran was elected. Okay, because I want to say it was 1991 that we went in. I'm gonna have to look into this. But the point is it was a midterm election for Bush. Okay, George H.W. Bush, mm-hmm. And that was where that.
So that would have been 1990.
Yeah, exactly. So November of 1990 was when that happened. And I want to say that the Gulf War happened in 91. I'm pretty sure that it happened in 91. So the midterms happened before the Gulf War, right?
Let me... 1991.
Yeah, okay, so my memory serves me correctly. All right, good. Okay, so the Gulf War hadn't happened yet. You had George H.W. Bush, who was still reasonably popular at the time, but it was still a midterm election and it flipped. From that point on, the 8th District has been held by a Democrat. But the point is that that was a competitive district at mm-hmm. one point. Mm-hmm. And so people were upset enough, I guess, Paris was in that office for about a decade. So they had been with Reagan and then 2 years of Bush and for 10 years of Stan Paris. And finally, voters in the 8th were motivated and upset enough and said, okay, we're going to try this new Democrat, this new guy. And they didn't really need to, you know, redraw the lines that significantly, or maybe they did. I mean, I'd have to look back and see, you know, how the 8th district changed after the 1990 census. And again, if you look back to the General Assembly in 1990 was under Democratic control.
Right.
So there's the possibility that those congressional districts were changed and drawn to favor a Democrat, favoring somebody like Jim Moran to challenge and win.
Well, yeah, and Democrats have never looked back.
Yeah.
In that district. They've never really had a serious Republican challenger since then.
But where I'm going with this is they may have just tweaked the lines so that district was a little bit more. So let's say they had a more solid Democrat seat somewhere else. Mm-hmm. So they peeled off some Democrats from there and added them to the 8th. To make it a little bit more competitive. So in general, all of those seats became more competitive. I'm actually going somewhere with this.
Okay.
But let me go ahead and instead of rambling on here, formulate my argument stronger for next week, and we can go in and talk to it. And also I'll do a little bit more research. What I'm really getting at is anytime you think you're making things a little bit better for yourself in one district, you may be making them more competitive somewhere else.
Excellent.
And you probably
yeah.
are.
Yeah.
And if somebody rises to the occasion from the opposition, they might just surprise you.
They absolutely will. They will. That's why we watch this stuff. We watch for surprise. It's like watching NASCAR. Where's the wreck? We want to see the wreck.
Exactly. Well, all right. So I will freely admit to everybody, you've probably heard it a little bit. I have been a little distracted this week.
Yeah.
So not our most prepared and prepared conversation, but maybe these are our best conversations. So I'll go back and listen to this later. And maybe it's a pretty good podcast.
Yeah. The ones you're unprepared for are usually the ones. God, that was a gem. I should keep that.
It's brilliant.
It was brilliant. I didn't know. But if you're like me, though, you think, my God, I sound like that. What happened to me?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, you stay safe. I know you're prepared for rain. You cleaned your gutters out today. I cleaned my gutters out yesterday. In the span of our having this conversation, I've had 2 rain bands come through.
Ooh.
So we'll see.
It's a coming.
It's a coming.
Yep.
All right. So he's Norm Leahy, which is _Norm_Leahy on Twitter, as well as all his columns on The Washington Post. I'm J.R. Heft on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, as well as here, jrheft.com. And we're shouting along the James. Until next week, Norm, let's not float along the James.
Let's hope not. And I hope everybody stays safe.